Hello everyone, my name is Jacob Minnick. I am the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Casey Arriaga. Casey is a licensed mental health clinician. Casey is also the host of the Addiction in the Family Podcast. Casey is also the author of two books. One is The Spirituality for People Who Hate Spirituality, and the other is Realistic Hope, the Family Survival Guide for Facing Alcoholism and Other Addictions. Today, we will get a deeper dive into Casey's podcast, his two books, as well as his recovery story, and much more. I, for one, am truly excited, and let's get this party going. Well, Casey, again, man, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, man, I just, speaking to someone with like two books under their name and your experience, I know it's going to be an awesome roller coaster, like a good fun roller coaster, and we're going to have a blast.
There's nothing like a good fun roller coaster.
Exactly.
Let's get that right.
Exactly. And just, I don't know, right off the bat, man, what would you say is your recovery story? What made you really want to get into the field of addiction?
Well, my recovery story starts when I was about 30, and my addiction story starts when I was about somewhere between birth and 3 months old. It's just been kind of going nonstop, and through therapy and recovery, I've had a few memories come up that have been sort of outside verified as much as one can. Mm-hmm. And one of them is that when I was very, very, very small, I was nursing with my mom and my birth mother. And I had this little flash of memory of looking up at her and thinking, I need to hold her attention for as long as possible, and I need to get as much as I can as fast as I can. And that kind of set the template for like everything. Yep. From there forward was just like, that's my MO right there. And so, you know, I could tell the whole war story kind of thing, but basically it, you know, I spent a lifetime trying to escape, you know, try and get away from who I am. And yet at the same time, I also had this idea, sort of spiritual idea, I would say, from a very young age, that I could change things positively in my life, that it would be possible. If I change my thinking, change my actions, things will get better. And that came after the fifth grade when I did zero homework, no schoolwork, basically skipped the fifth grade, even though I was in fact sitting in a class. And parent-teacher conferences came up and I was panicking inside. I actually developed an ulcer. And so since my parents didn't know the parent-teacher conferences were coming up, they didn't know why this was. They're like, oh my God, you poor kid. And I'm having milkshakes for dinner every night. I'm thinking, okay, this is not so bad. And then of course the conferences came up and my parents sat me down, especially my dad. And he was not a super emotionally expressive guy at time, you know, a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of problems with alcohol himself. You know, a lot of stuff he had gone through as a kid. So he was doing the best he could, but he tried to sit me down and be like, so son, like, what do you think about all year? Like this whole school, you haven't done anything. And I had no words or way to really express what was happening in my little mind. So I made something up like ice cream. And of course my dad's probably thinking like, you did not spend 9 months thinking about ice cream, but we didn't communicate well enough to like get through that conversation any better than that. I think he just kind of threw up his hands, but I came out of that just thinking like, that was a horrible experience. Things have got to get better. So in some ways at that point I hit bottom, but in other ways around that same age, I was thinking like, I'm going to get really good at escape.
Okay.
And so sex, love, food, that's probably where I start. Well, I'd say definitely that's where I started out. Over time I added alcohol to the mix and you know, things as they do started out okay. And I had a solution to my problems, which was my addiction. And then after a while, the solution became a problem and all the original problems were still there. So fast forward now till I'm about 30. Now I'm married 10 years at that point, had a 2-year-old kid. And I just knew like it was spiraling out of control.
Yeah,
I was still trying to control it. I was still thinking there's got to be some way to beat the system, because that was always my mindset. I can't play within the rules, got to beat the system. And so I went to go see a therapist. Okay. And in the first few minutes of the very first session, she looked at me and she said, have you ever heard of sex addiction? I'm like, no, but now that you've said that out loud, that is probably what's happening here. Later, I figured out I needed to stop drinking to make that work. I like to establish my recovery. And so I ended up in several recovery fellowships, which were incredibly beneficial and still are in my life. I'm still very active in those things. But one place I did not find any recovery was money. And so my financial life was still based on trying to beat the system, borrow money. And so I ended up at one point with over $200,000 in debt. And on that basis, the only possible way out of it was to sell our house and move to another state.
Can I ask you, what was that debt mostly from? Like student loans, credit card bills?
We actually took out a home equity line of credit. Our house had, you know, we bought our house kind of at the bottom of the market and it was a total fixer-upper. And so it had gone up like that much in value. So the bank was like, sure, you can borrow this money. You guys have a great credit score. Go to town. So we did two things you're never supposed to do on a home equity line of credit. One of them is my wife started a business. And the other one is I went back to school. And so I remember reading something a few months later saying like, you should never do these things. And I was kind of like, oh yeah, okay. But those rules are for the little people. I'm special Casey. That shouldn't apply to me.
Yeah.
So we kept on going anyway, and we just racked it up. And by the end of it, I was paying the home equity line of credit payment with the home equity line of credit. So in other words, I was borrowing more money from the line of credit to make payments on that same line of credit. So basically I was a one-man Ponzi scheme. Need to say it was not going to last. So
we were like in a big hole, right? I can imagine you kind of just digging in a huge hole.
I was digging a hole and pouring the dirt over my own head.
Yep.
So I figured out the only thing we could possibly do was to sell the house and move. Now at this point, again, I had recovery in other areas. It didn't occur to me to apply it to money yet. That came years later.
Now, can I just, like, so your therapist is like, quit the alcohol and that will help with your sex addiction?
No, she was just quit the sex addiction. I later figured out that a lot of my drinking was around that, like to facilitate it or lower my own defenses or lower someone else's defenses or just, you know, it made it easier. So it was kind of fuel to the fire there. But sex addiction definitely from, again, earliest childhood was always kind of my mindset. So now I'm getting new in recovery, got a few years, things are going okay. I'm a much better parent. I'm a better spouse. I get to keep my job, standing in society, legal status. Like, I'm like, dodge that bullet. Meantime, I'm totally digging a no recovery hole in my finances. So we moved to a new state and I was supposed to get this job in the new state and it kept falling through. Or more like, you know, hey, we'll hire in 2 weeks. Okay, it'd be 2 more weeks, it'd be 2 more weeks. And then here's maybe the higher power moment is somebody calls and says, hey, well, there's this other job. I know this boys ranch is what they call it, which is not actually true, but boys ranch. And you just need to get these young men up and get them their medications and kind of make sure they get to these groups. And I'm like, okay, look, I'll take any job at this point. So the house sold, we paid off the line of credit. We're like, okay, we just scraped under the gate there, starting over again. And so I'm like, I'll do whatever job. So I walk into this job interview and the guy says, do you know anything about recovery from addiction? I'm like, well, at that point, I'm like, well, I got a couple of years sober. Sure. He's like, great. So we're an addiction treatment center. I'm like, oh, okay. I've heard of those. You know, isn't that like, you know, 28 days or something like that? Well, it turns out it was a 9 month to year long treatment center program for people who like burned out and failed out of every other treatment program there was. And so that was my first foray into the addiction treatment field. And that got me into the work. I found that I really enjoyed it. Like it clicked for me. And after about 6 months or so, my boss called me in the office and said, you should go be a counselor. And I'm like, you know, school has never worked out. Like I've started and stopped school a number of times and borrowed some good chunk of money to do that. And I don't know. So I sat down and had a like real long talk with my wife, but he did say one magic thing. He said, we'll pay half. I'm like, oh man, I think I got to do this. So I did. So I went back to school and I was thinking like, man, if I get an associate's degree, that would be amazing. So I could. It turns out that actually school is much easier when you're sober. Who knew? And so then I went through. So I got my associate's. I'm like, what do you do now? They're like, you go get your bachelor's. Okay. So I got my bachelor's degree. Like, what do you do now? Now you get your master's. I'm like, so all of a sudden I turn around. I go from this kid who skipped the fifth grade, showed up in body, but not mind or spirit, to a guy with a master's degree in social work. And that's all of a sudden, this is like what I do. And in the course of that, what I found from that first treatment center on is I loved working with people around recovery, but I also really loved working with the families. And I think the families are just dramatically underserved. Yes. In terms of, like, people don't even know they could have recovery as a family member, even though most people I know in recovery from addiction also qualify as for recovery as a family member. Like, very few of us are the only person in their entire family that has something going on with addiction.
Yep.
Yeah, whether it's previous generations, current generation, next generation, whatever it is. So I really got into that work, and that really inspired me to write that first book, Realistic Hope, which was built, like, it's called Realistic Hope, Family Survival Guide for Facing Alcoholism and Other Addictions, because I thought people need a survival guide. There just was not enough out there that I could find.
Yep.
There are books for family members, and I really respect them, but a lot of them are like memoirs, like, you know, my son's, you know, journey through his addiction kind of thing.
Yep.
Or, you know, what I went through with my mom. There's not a whole lot that say, like, here's what is going on in somebody's brain. Here's what's happening in treatment. Here's how you work on your communication. Here's how you become happier, whether your loved one gets sober or not. Here's what to expect at a recovery meeting. All these kinds of things. So I sat down to write that book, and that was my first book. Was just inspired by growing up around it, growing up in it, finding recovery, both as a person from my own addiction and then finding recovery as a family member. And yes, for the record, I did get into recovery around money. So, yeah, participated in a money recovery fellowship as well. And that's completely revolutionized my life in wonderful ways. And so through all of this, one of the things that I know is that everything flows from helping others. So if I'm not giving back, then I'm not maybe doing my job on this earth.
It's so cool. So the first treatment center you worked at was Adolescence, would you say?
You know, that's what it sounded like when they said Boys Ranch, but it turns out it was like 18 up. I think it was 18 to 25 was our main age range. Like, we would maybe occasionally take somebody 17 if they were going to turn 18 in our program.
Okay.
We might take 25 to turn 26, but that was really the core constituency, is young men and typically people who had, you know, not unusual for someone to come and say, oh, I've been treated 5 times, I've been treated 10 times, stuff like that, where they tried a lot of different things and were like, okay, we're going to do like this up on the side of a mountain in the mountainous north wilderness part of New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And we're going to run this sort of semi-wilderness program where these guys are up in the middle of nowhere. And a lot of them were like from New York City, they're from Miami, they're from Los Angeles. And they're like, what happened? And we're like, we're going to get you some recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty cool stuff.
It's such a beautiful thing. And it's always kind of sad when you hear the stories of like, oh, this is my 15th time in treatment, 20th time in treatment, you know, because you could just understand kind of like the frustration in their eyes, their heart, you know, like they're just tired.
Yeah, people get tired and people lose faith in themselves. They start to think maybe there's no hope for me. And so what I was focused on is like, I don't care how many times you've been to treatment. Let's see what it'll take to make this the last one. Like, what would that look like? What would it look like to stop doing this and get out of that cycle? And helping people take that deeper dive and resolve issues is one of the things that makes me really happy.
Yeah. Well, and as I was a tech at an adolescent treatment center, like the one thing you always worried about, especially if the adolescent or the client does very well, is what environment are they going back to? Is your biggest worry. You know, it's very sad because a lot of the clients in the treatment centers, they're going back to moms and dads and family members who are still using drugs in the house.
That can totally happen. One cool thing, and we've had this happen a few times at the place where I work now, which is called Windmill Wellness Ranch. It's a great program. Mm-hmm. It's not like set up to be 9 months to a year, although people have stayed for multiple months. It's not like a, you know, 3 to 4 week like spin dry kind of thing. It really, you can dig deeper into the issues. We had a few instances now where someone will come through treatment and then they go home to their spouse who is still drinking or using or whatever. And then a couple weeks later, the spouse now shows up in treatment. And so you're seeing that kind of like tag team thing. And I have a close friend and mentor in recovery who did that. He said, like, yeah, my wife went to treatment and she came home. We looked at each other and we were like, yeah, it's my turn, isn't it? Like, and now I need to get in there. And so seeing that, what I call like cascading recovery, where like one person gets recovery into family and then another person does and another person, you know, you can see it kind of ripple out just like addiction can. You see recovery ripple out. And I was fortunate, you know, in my own recovery, I got into recovery and I was sort of the identified patient of the family. I'm the one with like the problem.
Okay.
But about 3 years into my recovery, one day I come home and my wife is crying. I'm like, oh man, what's going on? She goes, I need to get into a program. And I'm like, needless to say, I support you 100%. It hadn't even crossed my mind. Like, I was so focused on, like, I need to get better. It isn't that I wasn't paying attention to her and her issues. I just, neither one of us framed our issues in terms of addiction. We just thought, this is who I am. Right. And, you know, I also, again, had that sort of special Casey thing in my own head, like the rules don't apply to me. So, of course, I knew all these people who were in addiction. I knew people who were in recovery.
Yeah.
And I never stopped to think, like, why do I have so much in common with these people? But that was the reality, is that's one of the reasons that we were drawn to each other, I think.
Well, it's another interesting thing how you brought up your wife and like the family system and noticing issues. Like you said, there's a lot of scenarios where, okay, it's the one family member who we'll call the black sheep or whatever, who has the addiction issues, but it's really, it's a family system that acts as a whole that causes issues. So, and again, I'm not trying to play the blame game, but again, it's a family systems type of theory where I just wish there would be more treatment centers where they kind of bring the whole family involved throughout the process more, rather than, okay, just the one goes into treatment where the other family members are still in that same environment they were before doing the same things. Does that make sense?
It does. And it's one of the things that, among the other things that inspires me to do that family work, is seeing like what happens when the whole family starts to look and say, what could we be doing differently? And not just what can I do differently so my loved ones stay sober? What can I do better so my life gets better? Like, what if we get out of that identified patient model? What if we say everybody in the family has certainly the potential, you know, not like an obligation, but has the potential for recovery? And what does that look like? And so making that shift, you know, I run a family workshop at Windmill Wellness Ranch. One of, you know, a couple of cool things about it. One is that we do it every single weekend. And I've, you know, worked at places where, like that first place where it was really cool, we do like a 3 to 5 day weekend, you know, like extended weekend where the families come. It's really intensive, but they'd only get like that one shot at it. Like, this is your weekend. Or if they were doing like a 9 month, year long stay, we might do like one every 3 months. So you'd see the families start to evolve, look at their own recovery, stuff like that. Sometimes family members would come in for the second family workshop and they'd be like, I have a sober date now. So actually my loved one in treatment has longer sober than I do. But you see like that happen. But when we're doing the weekly thing, you can really see people start to shift their mindset. They show up at that first one, like, you know, I am here to get my loved one sober. And one of the first things I say is, oh, by the way, you can't actually do that. That doesn't exist.
Yes.
You can't get other people sober, but you can look at your own recovery. And so we get them to focus on their own recovery as much as possible. But another really cool thing is we've been able with our model to shift it so that alumni families are still coming back to the workshop. Awesome. So we'll have people come through and say, oh yeah, when my daughter came through treatment there 2 years ago, this is what it was like for me. Speaking to a family where like they're 1 week deep, you know, they're like, what happens here? What happens next? And someone can say, oh, I've been there 100%. Because the thing that always hits people is what happens afterwards. You know, that first few days you breathe these like, oh, my loved one made it to treatment. They're going to be okay. Everything's going to be good. And then like 2 days later, people wake up with start going like, oh my God, what happens when they leave? What are we going to do? And so to have people there, you know, not just me as a professional, because that's good up to a point, but being able to hear the voices of other people who can say, when my loved one was in treatment, here's what it was like for me. Here's what we did in that first month after. Here's what it looked like 6 months later. Here's what it looked like a year later. And getting that community. So those people a year or two later are still getting support for themselves by showing up, and they're giving back. And the brand new people get to hear just sort of that longer term experience. It's such a cool dynamic.
Well, yeah. And there's a type of learning to it where it's just like visual learning where it's like, hey, you know, that family seems somewhat similar to us. You know, if they can do it, we can do it. You know,
absolutely. And that's been the basis of addiction recovery now for, well, for a really long time. I mean, a lot of people would look at like AA and that's, let's see, 1935. So, you know, we're not quite at 100 years, but we're getting there.
Right.
But, you know, you look before that, there was the Washingtonians. You know, there's like a lot of groups that have all come up with this idea that we can get together. In fact, one of the original signers of the Declaration of Independence, you may know this, Benjamin Rush, you know, medical doctor, one of the fathers of American medicine, you know, literally signed the Declaration of Independence. And he said, coming out of the war, like, I've seen some of these men that I fought side by side with. These are courageous men. These are men of willpower. These are, you know, really great guys who nonetheless can't stop drinking rum, like no matter what they do. Yeah. And he said way back when, so we're talking, of course, the war ended. So we're saying, may liberally say 1780, somewhere in there. He said, you know, there might be someday a thing called like a sober house where people go together and they can recover together. And everyone's like, nah, man, nah, it's a moral failing. It's weakness. It's no willpower. And he's like, wait, no, but you know, he was before his time for sure. So fast forward to now, and people are accepting more that like, yes, this is in fact a disease. It's not, we don't say that as a metaphor. We don't say it as an excuse. It's like, this is what's actually happening in somebody's brain. So I think being able to look at the science is so important to get out of that blame and shame. Because in the family workshop, I'm not about saying, oh, it's the family's fault, but more just saying like, look, nobody chose this, but everybody's in it. So since we're in it, let's look at how maybe we can get out of it together. Instead of being at each other's necks, we could be at each other's backs and shoulder to shoulder in recovery.
Well, it's that biggest misconception our society has with people dealing with any type of mental health or addiction issues is like, oh, they're just criminals. They're just having a great old time, not even caring about anything. It's like, when I talk to most people who are going through addiction, they're not enjoying it. They're not happy. A lot of them will say like, I haven't been happy getting high or drunk in 20 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And getting to work with people in early recovery, I get to see that, you know, there's so much guilt and shame and all this kind of stuff. And people say, oh man, I lost my moral compass. I'm like, well, the good news and the bad news is you didn't. It is good news, because otherwise you would come out of addiction as a totally amoral person, but instead you feel horrible. And they're like, but I'm a horrible person. I'm like, no, if you're a horrible person, you wouldn't be worried about it. Mm-hmm. Horrible people never think that they're horrible people.
Yes.
if you're worried about what you did, if you feel bad about it, and that might take a few weeks to actually hit and really settle in, but when those feelings hit, that's a really good sign that you never lost your moral compass. But the tragedy of that is you got dragged behind your addiction against all your values, against all your morals, all that kind of stuff. Because one of the things I found in doing brain research for this stuff, so I can teach it and all this kind of thing, and just, you know, for my own edification, is that they're just completely different parts of the brain. You know, the part of the brain that's running the show in addiction is not the moral center of the brain. It's not the part that thinks ahead. It thinks like a whopping 45 seconds into the future.
Yep.
It does not care about consequences. And so when family members, again, can get it, when people with addiction can get that, it's just like this, aha, we're not horrible people.
Right.
We're actually good people who are trying to recover from a horrible disease. That's a different dynamic altogether.
Mm-hmm. No, I have this very sad story, and I would love your input on it. My dad, let's say, has this friend in Arizona, right? And I don't really know much about my dad's friend, but he has a son who's been struggling with alcoholism for a long, long time. And we think the base issue is that his brother was charged for murder here in Minnesota. And he's going through like a lot of trauma with that. So his dad thought it'd be a good idea to bring him down to Arizona, right? So long story short, you know, he's been drinking for 10 plus years, a case of beer every day. It gets to the point where he has to drink.
Yeah.
Right. And his parents love him, but they kind of both secretly know they're enabling him because he's had multiple DUIs. I even heard like he's afraid to drive because if he gets another DUI, he's going to get a felony and go to jail.
Yeah.
So his dad and his mom both drive him to work every day, because of his drinking, and they just continue it. So you kind of think there's like, okay, there's enabling, but they both love their son, you know, like, so it's, again, it's a very sticky situation.
Well, the thing that I go to you know, I just plug in the book, but I mean, it's the reason I wrote the book is in this section is looking at enabling and rescuing. And it's like the constant question that I always hear is, how can I tell if I'm enabling? How can I tell if I'm helping? Well, here's the thing. Enabling by definition means to make it possible, practical, or easy for somebody to do something. So that's not necessarily negative. Mm-hmm. Like I can enable someone to get into treatment. I say semi-jokingly, you know, when my daughter was like 5 years old, I enabled her to go to kindergarten. Like she wasn't going to be able to get there. So I made it possible, practical, and easy to provide the means and opportunity. So we got her there. What I have to look at, and this is where I find that dividing line actually maybe becomes more clear, is where are my values and where is my safety in this? So when I'm setting boundaries, figuring out enabling, like unhealthy versus healthy enabling, stuff like that, I have to look and say, am I being honest with myself? And there's a saying that gets used in 12-step recovery, to thine own self be true. It's a Shakespearean, you know, quote, of course, from Hamlet. And in Elizabethan English, what it meant was be honest with yourself. And I find when people are being honest with themselves, it's harder to get into unhealthy enabling. Like if my kid is hitting me up 4 times a week for $30 for gas, if I'm being honest with myself, I know unless you got like a hole in your gas tank, you're not actually going through that much gas. Mm-hmm. So to get an unhealthy enabling, be like, well, I'm going to give you this money and look the other way. I know where it's going, but I'm going to pretend like I don't. To do that, I have to be dishonest with myself. Yes. So being honest with myself, then I can look and say, wait a second. You know what? I don't actually agree with what's happening. So I'm not going to contribute to it. That's where I can say like, okay, this doesn't fit my values. So I'm not going to contribute to it. Whether it's picking my loved one up from treatment early, you know, like we all know it's not time to go home, but I'm going to come pick them up because I'm like, well, they're going to come home anyway. They'll call a taxi. Yeah, but you don't have to contribute to any of that. Right. You don't have to add to something that you disagree with or that doesn't fit your values. So I look at that and think like there's maybe an easier dividing line than trying to make this huge checklist of always do this, never do that. And I know people sometimes they'll show up at the family workshop and that's what they're looking for. They're like, just give me the list of all the right things to do and none of the wrong things to do. I'm like, here's the deal. You can't screw up somebody's recovery. If somebody decides to stay sober, there's nothing you can do to stop them. You know, and parents are like, how do I keep from contributing to their addiction? I'm like, well, unless they're asleep and you pour alcohol into their mouth or shoot them up, you can't contribute to their addiction. What you can do is do things that don't fit your morals and values. Like my personal morals and values, I don't panic if somebody comes over to my house, they're not somebody with a problem, and they have a glass of wine. I don't personally stock it in the house, but if they want to bring over a bottle of wine and, you know, they're the kind of people who are only going to drink half of it anyway and throw it away or save it for next year or whatever, hey, no problem. But people getting drunk at my house does not fit my values. People doing illegal drugs in my house does not work for me. Underage drinking, not going to happen. So those are all things where I don't set those boundaries and limits and all that kind of stuff thinking I'm going to change their behavior, but I can say I'm not going to contribute to it. So when somebody near and dear to me who was underage was like, oh yeah, so I brought pot. And so I'm like, well, that's illegal here. And wouldn't you know it, I'm a drug counselor. So not at my house. And this loved one of mine, you know, rolled their eyes and said, well, fine, I'll just smoke it down the street. I'm like, cool, that's between you and the cops. That has nothing to do with me. You know, I'm just saying I'm not going to contribute to it. I'm not going to enable it. So in that same way, like for your friends, if that fits their values and works for them, like, hey, I'll drive you to work. And that way I know that, you know, nothing else is happening. You're not going to crash the car. You're not going to go to jail. You're not going to hurt somebody, God forbid, all that kind of stuff. But I know that that makes it possible, practical and easy for you to keep drinking. Then you got that dilemma of saying like, okay, you know what? What fits my values? But there are some great guides for how it is that we get through those ethical or moral dilemmas. You can look at the pros and cons. Where's the greatest harm happening? We can get feedback from others. If you're of a spiritual nature, you could take it to your higher power and say like, okay, what feels like the thing that fits my values? Not the thing that's going to save them. Not the thing that's going to stop them from drinking. Because again, that doesn't really exist. But I can say, am I going to contribute to something I believe in? Or am I going to contribute to something I don't believe in? And I find that helps people a lot to just kind of find that peace.
You know, and like you said before, the first step is like looking within your value system. And secretly, if you go below your value system, I think it makes it easier and easier to do it over time. And then you're going down the black hole. And I think that's what might be happening here.
And that happens just like it happens for the person with the addiction. It can totally happen for the person next to the person with the addiction, where they turn around and they recognize, wow, I'm doing a lot of the same things. I'm getting dishonest. I'm rationalizing. I'm justifying. I'm doing things I don't believe in. I'm going against my own values. And worse than that, I'm doing it all stone cold sober. I mean, they at least have the excuse they were high or drunk, you know. I'm stone cold sober and I'm yelling at people around the house and throwing things like, well, hold on a second. How did I get so far off track? And more importantly, can I get back on track? And the answer is yes, ultimately you can. And that's where we get families into recovery.
Well, yeah, and it also too, I think a family can be there for like love and support, but deep down, I think it, like you said, it has to be that individual's want to get sober, to know deep within themselves that this is my path in life where I need to take to better my life.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's where I find, you know, we talk about people with addiction, like hitting bottom, you know, I have to hit bottom before I'm ready to change. Well, for a lot of family members, the same thing is true. They have to hit bottom, and they're not all going to hit bottom at the same time. You know, sometimes one person in the family hits bottom and the other person is ready to keep on going with the enabling or whatever. And that's where we find out that I'm always telling the family members to go to recovery fellowships, and someone may show up saying, oh, I'm going to Al-Anon or Smart Recovery Family and Friends or any of those programs or Families Anonymous. I'm going to go to that one because it's going to save my loved one. And they figure, okay, no, I'm there to focus on me. Stop controlling my loved one. Well, then we recognize, oh, wait a second. I need to stop controlling my spouse who is trying to control my loved one. Like maybe I have to let them just play their drama out. I'm just going to take a step back and say, well, I love you both, but I'm not getting in the middle of this anymore. I'm not going to contribute to it just by not putting any energy into it. So that recognition that, you know, family recovery sometimes points in all directions and not just at the person with the addiction.
You know, I would love to know what your therapeutic style is. Like when you work with families, right, and you're doing a family therapy session and you're kind of seeing those behaviors, do you have like a particular approach that you apply to?
Yeah, I mean, I try and approach with a certain amount of humor and goodwill. To start with, I always reserve the right to step in the middle of and interrupt people, because otherwise the family dynamic sometimes will just go running off. And then I've actually at one point said to families like, hey, look, if all you can do is argue in the session, you don't need me. You can do that for free at home. I had one couple where this is the most extreme I've ever done, is I actually had a book and I said, look, if you're just going to, I'm just going to read my book. So I just sat there and opened up my book. A little bit of a dramatic thing to do, but it was just still like making a point, like, so bring it back in, let's talk. But my biggest overarching thing is moving away from shame and blame and working on open, honest communication. And that's so much of family work just comes down to open, honest communication. Can I get honest about my feelings? Can I get honest about the whole range of things? Can I get honest about where I've been manipulative? Which again, applies just as much for family members. We'll totally get into manipulation. I'm going to manipulate you sober, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I guess I'd say that's my approach is, and also I would say having done it for a while, there are certain patterns that are not like a cookie cutter kind of thing, but you start to recognize over time of like, okay, everybody in the family probably feels responsible on some level. You know, the person with addiction thinks all the problems is their fault. Each parent thinks they must've screwed something up. The siblings feel like they should have said something earlier. The kids think if I'd been a better kid, you know, you name it, you could name almost any family relationship and somebody's going to think like, oh, maybe this is my fault. So helping to get people out of that, like first voice it and get honest with it and then move away from that. And then the biggest overarching message over all of it is everybody gets their own recovery instead of trying to manage somebody else's recovery.
So I got to ask, I got a really cool question. Well, it's not really cool, but I find it interesting. Have you ever been part of a situation where you're working with your client and you've been working with their family for some time now, and you've just come to the conclusion they're going to need a lot more work than you can provide them, and you don't feel like your client is safe going back into that same environment?
In terms of like saying, yes, you guys, well, for instance, if they're in treatment, I might say like, hey, you all need to continue family therapy after you get out. I'm not saying need to, but here's what we recommend. You know, let's get you some referrals and find somebody good, stuff like that. I've certainly had plenty of situations where I've said like, hey, I don't think you should go back into that environment. Now, sometimes people listen, sometimes they don't, but at the very least, I'm always clear. Here are some options. Here's some sober living houses you could go to, or maybe you've got a better idea. Maybe a relative you could live with who's sober and in better shape, but just kind of looking and seeing. And I'm reminded one time I was working with a young woman, probably mid-20s, something like that. And she was like, well, I have these two kids at home and I feel like, you know, I could go to this sober house that's farther away from them, or I could go to one that's not as good, that's closer. What do I do, Casey? And I said like, well, do whatever the best thing is for your recovery, because your kids need a sober mom.
Yeah.
Actually, I asked her, you know, do your kids need a sober mom farther from home or a drunk mom closer to home? And she was like, got it. Okay, cool. So letting people know they have options. I mean, it's one of the things as a social worker is one of the basic parts of the ethos is like the client has their own right to self-determination. They're going to make their own decisions. People are going to do whatever they're going to do. I mean, I can't preach to the families all day that you can't control somebody and then try and control them anyway. Right. But I can look and say, let me make sure I've laid out all the best options, made my presentation as to why I think these are the best options. And then I'll be clear with people. Look, you're an adult. You're going to make your own decisions. You decide what you think is going to work best for you. Here's mm-hmm. what we recommend and why. Go to it. And I'm here for support later if you change your mind.
Well, you know, especially when it comes to like placement, when it comes like high intensity, medium intensity, low intensity. Let me know if you've ever been a part of a situation like this, but like when it comes to placement, you'll do like an assessment, right? Mm-hmm. And I've had a handful where it'd be like the single mom, hardworking, they have a kid at home, they'd be living in an apartment, but they got some legal issues. So they come to me for an assessment and they're using heroin every day. And I have to do the assessment. And I'm like, yeah, I recommend residential treatment. And then they act like I just crushed their life. Mm-hmm. They're like, no, I can't. I got this full-time job. I got to take care of my son at home. No, what can we do? And you're kind of struggled because like you want to help them out, but then you got to do what like your clinical opinion says mm-hmm. is against residential, right?
Well, under those circumstances, yeah, I usually say pretty much the same thing each time, which is what's going to happen to all that stuff anyway if you keep using? Yep. Like if you're still using heroin, you're not going to have that job. You're not going to be raising those kids. You might not even be alive to like
you're
worry about
it. You're almost this. Doing it for the kid in a sense, maybe for the safety.
Absolutely. Like. Well, that is for a certain percentage of people. That's part of the motivation to get into treatment is for those kids. And increasingly, I mean, it's still way more rare than it should be, but increasingly there are places that a mother in those circumstances could go with her kids where they provide daycare and, you know, right. treatment and still, you know, make sure the kids are okay and all that kind of stuff. Cause the other thing that we run into is, you know, ethically at a certain point, it's like, well, if you're still out there doing heroin and you don't do whatever it takes to quit that, then now you're putting your kids in danger. It's just not just like you're not helping them. It's like, you're going to become part of the problem in their lives. So there's an opportunity here to actually do something about that. And again, at that point, that's where I have to let go and say like, okay, I've done what I can, unless it's something that's like, oh no, this is mandatory reporting. These kids are in imminent danger. In which case I would explain to the parents like, hey, look, here's the deal. I'm not doing this to strong arm anyone, but you're explaining situations where your kids are going to get hurt. And if that's the circumstance, then if you're not seeking treatment, then you are not looking out for the welfare of your child. Then we're obligated to say something about that. That's really difficult. And I'd say pretty rare. Most people get into treatment a long time before that becomes the conversation.
Yep. You'd be surprised though, man. You'd be surprised. Again, I don't know what it's like in Texas, but in Minnesota, like how many like charges they would get and not be recommended treatment.
Yeah, it's kind of I would say that it's again a large shift in our society that is slowly happening where people can recognize this is a disease. You know, if this person had, you know, colon cancer, we would be saying, you need to go to the hospital, right? We would say, you need to treat that. We wouldn't say, what's wrong with you? If you had listened to the right music, gone to the right church, been a better person, yeah. you wouldn't have this cancer and you wouldn't need treatment. It's like, no, this is what happens in somebody's brain. It's just that our brains, and people get really touchy and jumpy around brains.
But our society looks at that as two different things.
Yeah. And I think part of it is because addiction really sits in the part of our brain that most motivates us to do things and make decisions. And we judge most people's personalities by the decisions they make. So we look at somebody's decisions and say, oh, okay, you're a good person or a bad person based on your decisions and behavior. But that's the part of the brain where addiction sits and really messes somebody's nice. Life up. And if you haven't personally been through the experience of wanting to do better and feeling helpless to do so, then it can be really hard to relate to that. And you might think like, mm-hmm. oh no, just moral failing. I've never felt that way. But once you get up close to it, even if you haven't experienced it, you spend enough time around, you go like, okay, wait, these people are not deciding to do like be bad people. Right. They are really fighting the part of their conscious mind. The frontal lobe yes. is fighting the limbic system, which is stronger and has been around for millions of years longer. It's fighting the part of the brain that says like, no, I don't care what's good for you. I don't care what the outcomes are. I just want what I want right now. That's hard stuff.
Yep. And then you go through the withdrawal, the experiencing of the consequences. It's dreadful. It is dreadful.
All the emotions, all that stuff. And that is often why, while it's not the perfect thing for everyone, and I'm glad there are programs like, for instance, Smart Recovery that does not focus on spirituality or insist on spirituality, mm-hmm. sort of like doesn't take an opinion on it. But a lot of people turn to spirituality, which is the basis of 12-step recovery, which is far and away the world's most successful and, by the way, free way to get sober. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of people turn to spirituality and find some sort of spirituality that works for them, because that is a way to do sort of an end run around that tug of war that we keep losing between our limbic system and our frontal lobe, because it engages other parts of the brain, which is really, really cool stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got into writing the second book, Spirituality for People Who Hate Spirituality, because a lot of people come into the recovery field and they're like, I don't think I can be spiritual. I don't think I want to be spiritual. And yet that works for so many people. What do I do?
Mm-hmm.
And because partly of my own struggles and then getting to help a lot of other people through those struggles, that's what got me into writing the second book, because those tools can be so helpful for people. And yet too many people feel like it's beyond their reach or something that is not for them. Like they want mm-hmm. the benefits, but they don't know how to get there. And so I wanted to lay out a little bit of a roadmap that helps people.
Actually, and if you want, would you care to tell us a little bit more about your second book?
Yeah, man, like every author on earth, I would love to tell you about my second book. So yeah, like I said, Spirituality for People Who Hate Spirituality. And my kind of funny story around that is when I was writing the first book, Realistic Hope, you know, you're writing your first book, it's kind of like, well, I don't know if I'm even going to be able to finish it. I don't know mm-hmm. if it's going to be a real book, all this kind of stuff. So once that was done, there was a much greater sense of like, okay, I can do this. And so I also had somebody who I don't think they meant to be like challenging with it. Mm-hmm. I think with good intentions, they were kind of like, well, you know, Casey, a lot of people write books, like write one book, but how many people have two books in them? And so part of me was like, watch this. I have two books in me. So there's my ego coming into play. But the day that I finished Realistic Hope, I started writing the first few sentences of Spirituality for People Who Hate Spirituality because, as often happens for me, the title popped in my head and I thought it was a funny title, but still was like, but this is a good subject. So I started writing, and of course, same sort of thing, a little bit of like, well, I don't know how much I have to say. I joked with my wife, maybe this be a pamphlet. I don't know. Maybe like a postcard that I hand out, but maybe there'll be a lot of stuff to write about. And what I found is, as I was looking at things, I would come up with new questions. The questions would lead to more research, because I really, like the first book, I wanted it to be scientifically backed. So there's big reference section, lots of studies that I went through to figure out like what's real, what's not. Not so much as like what beliefs are real, what's not, but what spiritual practices work for people. Yes. You know, what can we demonstrably say? Like, for instance, we can say beyond a shadow of a doubt that prayer helps the person who is praying. Yes. We cannot say for certain that it helps the person that's being prayed for. There's some evidence for, then there's other studies where it doesn't come up with much.
Right.
And so when we look at that, we can say like, okay, for sure I should tell people they should pray, right? But then I come across another study that says, you know what, there is one circumstance in which prayer can be harmful. And that is if you are praying to something or someone that you think does not approve of you or has bad intent for you. And you would think like that'd be a no-brainer. And yet there are a lot of people who feel like I have a condemning, judgmental higher power, but that's what I have to pray to. Mm-hmm. And so they're putting their prayer out there. And that turns out to actually be bad for your mental health. So I've told people, look, if you have a contentious relationship with your higher power, not like hard for me to believe, but contentious, like you honestly think your higher power disapproves of you, doesn't like you, is going to condemn you, things like that. I'm honestly like, don't pray. Like stop praying there until you can shift that belief or that idea to something that is helpful for you. Because otherwise you could be doing more harm than good. So a lot of things that I came across that I did not know that I could look back and be like, well, that kind of makes sense. But there's a lot of things that make sense that don't turn out to be true too. So I really wanted to have a lot of scientific research behind this and really look at what are different spiritual systems? What are different types of belief? You know, what does it really mean to be agnostic? A lot of people in A have read the chapter We Agnostics and still walk out going, but what exactly is an agnostic? Like, am I one of those people? What does that mean? Like, everyone kind of has an idea of what atheist means. Agnostic, a little more out there. Most people never even cross their mind that there's such a word as theist. So I could be an atheist or I could be a theist, someone who definitely does believe there is for certain a deity or deities. And looking at like, what are these different things? And then the largest growing category, especially sort of in the quote unquote Western civilization world, is spiritual but not religious, or they say SBNR. Okay. So I learned that one by doing the research, like, okay, SBNR. And what I found is in some ways I could fit into every one of those categories in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And found that a lot of people would be surprised to find out that you could be like several of those categories at the same time, depending on how you define that. So I looked at some different definitions. But the really important thing for me is in the last chapter, which is here's some practical hands-on stuff you can do. Like if you're not sure how to pray in a way that might work for you, here's something that works for a lot of people. No matter what you believe, no matter how you believe it, even if you're not sure that you believe, here's this, you know, ways to pray that could work for you. Here's what meditation might look like. Here's some, I basically set up like three different guided meditations. Here's how you can look at what types of happiness am I chasing? How do I get to those? You know, where does spirituality fit into it? And then just that idea of having a really broad, open sense of spirituality, just a sense of connection to something greater than yourself. I really wanted to present that to people so that no matter what you believe or don't believe, you can get the gifts of spirituality, even if you're not sure what your higher power is. Like you can have the gifts of spirituality, never being certain what your higher power is, never mm-hmm. needing to define it, just having some sense there's something on my side and saying, maybe that's good enough. That'll get me out of the gate. And it turns out it will.
Well, and a lot of times too, I'll explain to my clients, like you said, a higher power can also be anything. Too, except majority of our society thinks, oh, well, it's God. Higher power is always like God. It's like, well, no, that's not always the truth.
Yeah, and even that, you know, a lot of people will take the word God, take the three letters, G-O-D, and say like, okay, let's break that down. So you can start off maybe like grow or die or gift of desperation and then move into great outdoors, good orderly direction. One that I like there's sort of that apocryphal thing. I've never met anybody who actually has a doorknob as their higher power, but a lot of people, you can be a doorknob. So I would fine, G-O-D, good old doorknob. Like if that's where you want to go, there's your acronym. So wherever it is that you look, whether you look to nature, the spirit of the universe, if you look to the group of other people in recovery and somebody mm-hmm. near and dear to me, that is their higher powers, the spirit and like the worldwide energy and spirit of all the people recovering successfully right now. I'm like, cool, group of drunks, group of druggies, group of darlings. For those of us where it's not primarily chemicals, like wherever you go, there is some way you can take that word God if that gets in your way, but you don't have to use the word God. You know, if you're doing 12 step recovery, you can go through all 12 steps and say higher power instead. You will be just fine. Yep. It will work just as well for you. You can do smart recovery and say like, okay, yep, I am just going to use this amorphous. I'm not sure what it is. Maybe the right side of my brain is talking to the left side of my brain. Yeah. And you know what? That's okay. Because it still gets around and does that end run around the limbic system, because actually spirituality, that sense of connection, helps our limbic system to relax and kind of tone it down and be like, oh, we're going to be okay. Because mm-hmm. one of the big takeaways from spirituality is I'm connected and I'm going to be okay. And human beings love to feel connected. And we suffer if we don't feel connected, which addiction often pushes us away from recovery or from connection. Therefore, recovery wants to push us towards connection.
Well, and I think of it, I believe you could use it as two ways too, because what I was going to get into is, like you said earlier, you have to at least try it. Like there's a lot of different avenues and it may not all work for you, mm-hmm. but you have to try it. But most importantly, you have to believe in what you're doing. And then if it does have a positive aspect in your life, you kind of see, okay, how can I use this throughout my life to gain spirituality, enrich my life? And also there's that consistency part too, where you have to constantly keep doing it every day.
Yeah. And one of the things that I laid out in the book is I took the scientific method, because this mirrored something that I did when I was first starting to pray myself and not mm-hmm. really believing in it. Because you're like, you have to believe in it. It's like, well, I did not. I was certain that I was wasting my time and talking to the thin air. Mm-hmm. I was just so tired of getting what I'd already gotten. I'm like, okay, I need to do something different. So I took the scientific method and just broke it down and said, okay, I'm going to come up with a hypothesis. There might be a higher power. Notice might be a higher power. Mm-hmm. And then even I broke that down. I thought I'm never going to be able to prove if that's true or not. So I need a provable hypothesis. So my hypothesis became prayer might help me. That I can prove or not. Either my life's getting better or it's not. mm-hmm. you know, externally, internally, whatever. Like, this is improving things. So there's my hypothesis. Had to design an experiment. That's easy. That was already done for me. Pray. Whatever it is that looks like for you. And prayer is just talking to a higher power, whether that's journaling, throwing runes, kneeling by the bed and folding your hands, dancing ecstatically, singing, whatever it is that looks like for you.
Yeah.
So find some way to try and talk to that higher power. And so there's my experiment. Now I want to gather data. Based on that data, I can start to get observable results.
Mm-hmm.
And then based on that, I can either revise my hypothesis or say, yep, I got it, or I know for certain that it doesn't work. And of course, like any good scientific experiment, the more data you have, the better your results are probably going to be. So I set out to gather a whole bunch of data by doing a whole lot of prayer. And I found that slowly but surely, I started to feel better. And I could not say for certain that outside things were changing, but I could say for certain that inside things were changing. I was feeling a greater sense of peace. I knew I felt better about myself. It was easier to stay sober. So that was the original idea. But more importantly, I just liked myself and I liked my life better. And that became absolutely worth doing.
You know, I think it's really cool is like, one, you had like healthy expectations where it may help, but then you're also open to like other avenues that it could help you in your life. Like, oh, well, I think it might just help me in this area. When throughout time you figure, oh, wait, it's helping me in the, something else. There's another area in my life. You're open to it.
Absolutely. And so today I could say I take all kinds of things to prayer. Just saying like, okay, higher power, I'm open to this. And I'm a big fan of two-way prayer. So I talk about that in the book and kind of mm-hmm. outline how to do that for people that have not heard of that, which is kind of a prayer, meditation, and journaling technique all wrapped up in one. It's very simple. And once you get that rolling, then it can become, as some people say in recovery, kind of a working part of the mind. So I can just be going through my day and I feel like I have my antenna up and I'm just putting those questions out there. What do I do about this? And it's not a style of prayer where I say, you know, dear higher power, please bring me a puppy dog and a rocket ship. It's a style of prayer where I'm like, show me what to do. Bring me some mm-hmm. guidance. Guidance I can use. And, you know, guidance keeps showing up. And that guidance makes my life better for sure. Whether it's words in a journal or a picture in my mind of, or just that kind of tug or hearing somebody say something. And I go like, yeah, that just sounds right. You know, mm-hmm. that's the voice of my higher power right there.
That's awesome, man. That's really beautiful. It is. Now, I want to get into, and I think this is something we can both relate to, your podcast, man. I think it's awesome that you're a host of a podcast like myself. Tell me how that got started, man.
Yeah, so I started the podcast originally as advanced publicity for this book because I knew I was writing a book for family members. So I called the podcast Addiction and the Family. Mm-hmm. As I have to be careful because when I say it too fast, it sounds like addiction in the family, it was addiction and the family. So I started the podcast. I opened up a Twitter account. I had never tweeted before. So I was going to mm-hmm. learn how to do the social media thing. And I'm going to figure out how to do a podcast. But I was coming out of a background of being a musician and doing a lot of recording. So it was partly an easy call because I was starting to write the book. So I had some material to start with. And I already had like, you know, a good microphone and good recording software. I knew audio editing. I'm like, okay, we can do this. And as a musician, I thought like, and I can also write some music for it. So it kind of became a thing where it's like, okay, I'm going to have music. I really looked up to radio shows like This American Life, Fresh Air for the interview style, Snap Judgment for like the music and the humor and stuff like that. So I looked up to these things and I thought like, okay, I want to do something like that, but for recovery. And so we set out and just said, let's see what happens. I have no idea if there's a big audience out there for this or not. I didn't have an idea of how many people were doing recovery podcasts. And there are so many people, and I love it. There's such a wide field of people doing recovery podcasts. So I started out to do that. And we just kind of launched down the world. And, you know, our first episode on day one got zero listeners. And I was like, okay. So initially I'm like monitoring every day. How many people listen? What happened? I discipline myself once a week. Once a week, I'm allowed to look at statistics and see like what actually happened. And so when I opened it up this last week, we had just gotten over 20,000 streams.
Nice.
And
congrats.
You know, we're launching a new episode now. We do it just once a month. You know, I think we're now getting around 150 listeners on the first day. And just looking at like how these things grow. We've been hurt on every continent except Antarctica, and I still want somebody to tell me, like, how do I break into that market, man? Somebody in Antarctica has got to listen to this so we have a clean sweep. But it's just really cool thinking, like, I had no idea, talk about like a higher power thing, I had no idea going in that it would reach that many people. Like, I haven't sold 20,000 books, but I've got 20,000 people listen to the same basic message. And I recognized early on, actually, probably the first few episodes, I think I looked at my wife and I went, like, maybe the podcast is going to do what I thought the book was going to do. But what's really cool is I found they go well hand in hand, because they're kind of initially some of the episodes were, in fact, me writing a script out of a chapter of the book and, you know, creating that or saying, here's a topic we want to talk about. And then, of course, like a lot of people, we got into interviewing people and got into stuff like that, which I found I really enjoy interviewing because it's a lot of those same counseling skills. And we just kind of got off and running, and it took on a life of its own, like these things do. And so now it's just a really, really cool thing that we do each month to get the message of recovery out there, especially for family members. But I've been really grateful to see how many people in recovery directly also listen to it and, you know, make comments about it and say, oh, hey, I got this thing, or I turned my mom out of this episode, so now we're both thinking the same way about boundaries or something like that. That kind of stuff really warms my heart.
Yeah, I don't know about you, man, but it's just like, I love the journey. Like right now, when I'm talking to you right now, I love hearing about people's life stories, their journeys. I feel like I'm like right there with you, or right there with my guests in their journey. And that, I don't know, that really gets me going, man. I have a strong passion for that, you know, and I don't know if you feel similar in some ways, but
I do. I just feel this sense of camaraderie. I think when I first just thought to myself, like, are there other people doing recovery podcasts? What does it look like? So I started listening to some, and I think one of the first ones I listened to was Love Sober, which I'm not sure that they're still going or not, but it's a couple women from England. One was living in France at the time. So it's like one's in England, one's in France, but they're both British, and just listening to their dialogue. And they, you know, you could tell they just got in there, hit the record button. They would just talk for a bit, maybe bring in a guest, just see where the conversation went. And I just found, like, I found myself like feeling like, yeah, these are really cool people. I've never met them. I don't know what they look like. It doesn't matter. Just this sense of like, yeah, I feel like I'm connected to something worldwide here. And that has been an amazing experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So now, as we wrap things up, I have to ask you, what are your future passion goals and projects? You know, what do you hope to accomplish in your life, let's say 5 to 10 years?
Well, one of the things is getting more of that recovery message out. So obviously I want to let people know about realistic hope. I want to let people know about spirituality for people who hate spirituality. I want to let people know about the podcast. I'm actually really fortunate. On September 10th here in Texas, I'm going to be speaking at the Texas Association for Addiction Professionals statewide conference, presenting on how to work with families. So kind of getting that message out in different ways. There's so many different ways to kind of get the message of recovery, help people directly. And then now I'm having increasing opportunities that I really appreciate, being able to help other professionals help other people. So just watching that ripple out. I'm working on book number 3, you know, in that same style. As soon as I finished up Spirituality for People Who Hate Spirituality, on that same day, like, I got everything formatted and I'm like, okay, and here's the beginning of the next book. Cause that next title popped in my head. It's still gestational, so I'm not putting it out there too much, but working on book number 3. So, you know, if you talk about in 5 years, my hope is I've got 5 books, and we're just getting more of the message out there, keep growing the podcast, keep speaking, keep doing family workshops, keep teaching, keep helping people, and stay in recovery myself. And man, if I can pull all that off while still hanging out playing games with my kid, then it's a pretty good life.
Well, and like we talked about earlier, you learn so much from other people. And just in this episode, I learned so much from you and your approach, and it gets me thinking about like other avenues I could get into, and like I really benefit from that, man. I really do. And it's just been a great honor having you on, man. It really has.
Thanks. And then, you know, the bottom line that I'm going to say, to touch one last thing on the spirituality, is, you know, when you say like, what are your goals, I just named my goals, but who knows what my higher power has in mind. So really, my biggest goal is whatever my higher power wants me to be doing in 5 years or 10 years, hopefully I'm doing that.
Amen. Now, if any of my listeners do want to get a hold of you, is there a particular way they could make contact with you, through email, LinkedIn?
Sure. Whatever? So again, if you go on Twitter, you could look up Addiction in the Family podcast, or the Twitter handle is @addictionfamily. We're also on Facebook under Addiction in the Family and also Realistic Hope. If you want to email directly, you can reach out to me at recoverytreebooks@gmail.com or addictionandthefamily@gmail.com. Either email address should work. And yeah, I'd love to hear from anybody.
Oh, absolutely. And again, Casey, it was an awesome pleasure, man. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, and I should do the right thing and mention, yes, and the books are available on Amazon, email or print. So yeah.
And I will make sure I put those links on my show notes, so it'll be just one click away for everyone.
Beautiful. Thank you. So thank you so much for having me on. This was a great pleasure and what a fun talk.
Yeah, it was a blast, man. I loved it.
I again want to thank Casey for another amazing BHI episode. I also want to thank all my listeners for your support. And I want to inform everyone that the content expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself dealing with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a licensed medical doctor or a licensed mental health professional. All right, everyone, until next time, thank you and have a good day. Bye.